Good morning, everyone. Before we start reading, I want to show you this. We just received yesterday copies of English of Savitri, Volume 4, Book 10. So this will be available at the information desk and from Shabda from this week onwards. So we were reading in Book 2, Canto 6, The Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. And we reached page 184, and we stopped reading at line 404. Sri Aurobindo is telling us about people who are moved by this higher life, but many of them, he says, are content just to be great in their own limited sphere. But he implies that this shouldn't really be enough for this strength, the strength of the greater life within us, which he says is the steward of the person with a capital P, the Purusha, the true inner person and his fate. So we'll read on from there. Varadarajan, would you begin, please?
This was transition line and starting point, the first integration into heavenliness for all who cross into that brilliant sphere. These are kinsmen of our earthly race. This region borders on our mortal state. This wider world of our greater moment with its strong formations build our growing selves. Its creatures are our greater replicas, complete the type we only initiate and are securely what we strive to be, as if part of eternal characters entire, not pulled as we by contrary tides, they follow the unseen leader in the heart, their lives obey the inner nature's law. There is that grandiose story, the hero's mode, the soul is the watchful builder of his spirit. Man is a spirit indifferent and inert. They choose their side, they see the God they adore, their battle is joined between the true and false, their pilgrimage sets out to the divine light.
So he says, this was transition line and starting point, a first immigration into heavenliness, this movement into the greater life. And I think I mentioned when we started reading this canto that I think that all of us who are here, we have made a first immigration. We've taken this step into the greater life. We're no longer dominated by the godheads of the little life who are so small and mean and petty. We've had a vision, Sri Aurobindo and Mother have given us a vision of higher things. And if we are sitting here today, it's because we want to know more and to rise higher and higher into that greater life. So he says, the beings of that world, they are the kinsmen, the close relatives of our earthly human race. And this region of the greater life, it borders on our mortal state. The beings there, of course, are immortal. They are not subject to death the way that we are. But nevertheless, we are close relatives of those beings there, and they help us to develop further, rise higher in our consciousness. Jocelyn, would you read? Thank you. It sounds like what we're aiming at, yes, yes indeed. But he says the beings in that world, we are mixed, no? they complete the types we are only starting to achieve. They have securely achieved what we strive to be. They're not pulled by, like we are, by contrary tides. We get pulled by all kinds of different impulses, no? But those beings follow the unseen leader in the heart. That's what we are trying to do, no? Their lives obey the inner nature's law. And in that world, all the high possibilities are kept. Grandeur's store, the hero's mold, the soul is the watchful builder of its fate. And none of them, he says, is a spirit indifferent and inert. The beings of the realm of the little life, they don't care much, no? They're indifferent and inert. But these greater beings, they choose which side they are living for. They see which God they're adoring. And because of that, there's a battle between the true and the false. The beings that Jocelyn read about, they are the ones who call in truth, want to live for the truth, fill their thoughts with her inspired voice, till in her sun-gold Godhead they too share. But those are not the only kind of beings found there in this world of the greater life. There's another, the opposites are also found there. If you would read, please, Margaret.
Or to the truth of darkness they subscribe. There's a for heaven or hell, they must wage war. Warriors of good, they serve a shining cause. Or are evil soldiers in the pay of sin. For evil and good, an equal can be achieved. Their ever knowledge is ignorant in all powers of life towards their Godhead in the whiteness and the daring. That air, each builds its temple and expands its power. And sin too, there is a divinity.
Thank you. So this is the opposite, no? Those who subscribe to the truth of darkness, an opposite kind of truth. So the beings there are either warriors of good or they are evil soldiers. And this happens wherever knowledge and ignorance are twins, as it is in our world too. Evil and good, an equal tenure keep. Yes?
What does it mean, an equal tenure keep?
Yes, an equal tenure keep. Each of them has an equal territory or an equal power. And this is a factor or a quality of our world that has bothered philosophers a lot and people who want to rise to a higher life. They've even been religions that posit that these are permanently two equal powers, light and darkness, good and evil. No?
This is the mythology we use, this Asura and Deva and the snake.
Yes, and the Zoroastrian religion, it had this theory of Manichaeism, that they're permanently equal powers. And of course we can choose which side we play. Sri Aurobindo doesn't subscribe to that view, no? But obviously there are stages in our development when it feels like this, that evil and good, an equal tenure keep. It's a very distressing characteristic of our own world. No? Which line, sorry?
4-4.
Yes.
For even ignorance there aspires to know.
Yes, there's a battle is joined between the true and false, and at least some of them set out on a pilgrimage to the divine light, and ignorance aspires to know. He describes the ones who, first of all, who are aiming for what we would call good, truth. That description goes on until line 434. And then he describes the opposite ones. And then he says all powers of life, all the powers of life, there's beauty and there's energy and just power, all kinds of different powers. They tend towards their Godhead, their divine absolute, in the wideness and the daring of that air. Everything is trying to be as completely itself as it can. Each builds its own temple and expands its cult. It does missionary work and tries to draw in more disciples. And among those powers of life, even sin is a divinity. It's a very difficult thing to understand. But I remember when we were reading this quite some years ago, there was a young man here from Haiti, and that island in the Caribbean. And he said, yes, in my country, we worship sin. There's a God there. And if you want certain things, he's the person to go and ask it for. So in that world, it's a world of life. It doesn't have a morality, kind of morality that we hope for and try to live according to. So we could read a little bit about sin, Paula. Yeah, the next one, affirming the beauty.
Affirming the beauty under her law, she claims life as her natural domain, assumes the world's throne, or dons the papal robe. Her worshippers proclaim her sacred right. A red tiara of falsehood they revere, worship the shadow of a crooked god amid the black idea that twists the brain, or lie with the harlot power that slaves the soul. A mastering virtue statuesques the pose, or a titan passion goads to a proud unrest. At wisdom's altar, they are kings and priests, or their life a sacrifice to an idol of power. Or beauty shines on them like a wandering star, too far to reach. Passionate, they follow her light. In art and life, they catch the all-beautiful's ray and make the world their radiant treasure house. Even common figures with marble robe, a charm and greatness locked in every hour, awakes the joy which sleeps in all things made. A mighty victory or a mighty fall, a throne in heaven or a pit in hell. The dual energy they have justified and marked their souls with her tremendous seal. Whatever fate may do to them, they have earned. Something they have done, something they have been, they live.
Thank you.
A basic grammatical question. Who is the she? Who is that?
Life. These are the powers of life. And I think it's this contradictoriness of life, this apparent immorality of life or life's indifference to morality that has made many people aspiring for spirituality, for spiritual growth, to think that they have to withdraw from life, that life is too difficult to deal with. But that is not Sri Aurobindo's view. He wants us to see that life is, he said, a steward of the person, of the inner being and his fate. Life, the life power, is meant to serve our inner growth, and we shouldn't turn away from it. We shouldn't make ourselves weak and feeble by refusing the powers of life. Rather, we should be striving to master them, allow our inner consciousness to be strong enough to make the right choices and to follow them. And of course, those people who worship beauty, they are the great artists and creators in our humanity. But whichever way it is, whether it's a mighty victory of the spirit or a mighty fall into a pit in hell, those beings have justified the dual energy, this life energy, which looks both ways. They marked their soul with her tremendous seal of energy, of life. Whatever fate may do to them, they have earned. Something they have done, something they have been, something they live. We remember them, some of these great titans. Napoleon, for example, springs to mind. Patricia, what do you read?
There, matter is soul's result and not its cause. In a contrary balance to earth's truth of things, the gross weighs less, the subtle counts for more. On inner values hangs the outer flag, or quivers with on the thought.
As.
Oh, yes, thanks. As quivers with the thought the expressive word, as yearns the act with the passion of the soul, this world's apparent, sensible design looks vibrant back to some interior mind. A mind not limited by external sense gave figures to the spirit's imponderables. The world's impulse, without channels registered, and turned into the body's concrete thrill, the vivid workings of a bodiless force. Powers here subliminal, that act unseen, or in ambush crouch, waiting behind the wall, came out in front, uncovering their face.
Thank you. This first sentence is important. The difference between that subtle world and our world. There, in that matter, in that world, they see matter, firm matter, as the result. It's a densification, a projection of the soul. It's not that matter that is the cause of the soul. Here in our world, our materialist education has taught us that matter is primary, and then there's life, and then there's mind, and then maybe there's something like soul or spirit. But there it is seen that soul, spirit, is the origin of things, and matter is its result, not its cause. That's a contrary balance to our material way of looking at things. No? There, the gross, all this heavy, dense stuff, weighs less. It's less important. And the subtle, what's happening in the subtle worlds, the values of the subtle worlds, are more significant, more important.
But is matter there? Is like our matter, or is it another?
It's another matter. It's a much subtler kind of matter. Yeah. And then he applies this to our world. He says, this world, our material world, here everything, it seems as if we can touch and feel everything, its apparent sensible design, is actually looking back, vibrating with, pendant on some inner power, some interior might. And he gives examples of ways we might experience that in our world here. When the thought quivers in the expressive word, when Sri Aurobindo speaks a word, or especially we hear it in Mother's voice when she reads these lines, how much consciousness she puts into these expressive words so that we catch the thought behind. And sometimes actions express the intense yearning of the soul, no? In this way, even in our world, the outer depends upon the inner, looks back to some interior inner might. And that's much more true in that realm of greater life. Don, you'd like to read?
In the communion?
A mind, I think. A mind not limited.
Oh, a mind not limited. A mind not limited by external sense gave figures to the spirit's imponderables. The world's impact, without channels registered, and turned into the body's concrete thrill, the vivid workings of a bodiless force. Powers here subliminal that act unseen, or in ambush crouch, waiting behind the wall, came out in front, uncovering their face. The occult grew there overt, the obvious kept a covert turn and shouldered the unknown. The unseen was felt and jostled visible shapes.
Let's pause there. Wherever there's life and matter, there's also mind, spirit, soul. So in that world, the mind is not limited as our minds often are, by the exterior senses, by the outer sense. That mind is able to give forms, images to imponderables. Anybody can help me with this word?
Something that exists but you can't think of.
Yes, what does Rand Hicks say? It's a bit like unpredictable, indefinable.
Unthinkable.
Yes, see what he says. Imponderable. But pondering is thinking.
A substance without measurable weight. For example, the ether.
The spirit's imponderable.
The ether. The ether. The ether is that which we generally have no idea about.
Yeah.
So
there are qualities and powers of the spirit which we can't conceive of.
Okay.
But in that world, the mind is able to conceive and even give image and give figures to those things which for us are inconceivable characteristics of
the spirit. Wouldn't the soul, even though it's referred to often, but wouldn't the soul also be
for us, it's a bit imponderable, isn't it? Unless we've had a direct experience of it.
But this is saying that
the mind in that world
can give figures to the soul's mystery.
Yes, mysteries is a good, yes.
Something like that.
Yes. And it also, it does another thing, it registers the world, its impacts, without channels. For us, the impacts of the outer world, the world outside our body, they come to us through our senses, either by the sense of touch or vision or hearing or taste or smell. And those things pass through the nerves. No? But here it's a direct contact. The world's impacts, that mind registered the world's impacts without channels and turns directly into the body's concrete thrill, the vivid workings of a bodiless force. So I think that connects with what Turiya was asking. Body there is also more sensitive. It's not like our dense physical body. It can respond directly to the world's impacts, the workings of a bodiless force. And in our world, there are powers that we are not aware of, because, he says, they're waiting behind the wall, crouching, hidden, subliminal. They don't cross the threshold of our awareness. They're subliminal to us. But still, they act on us. We don't notice them. They act unseen, and they're hiding, ready to jump out on us. There they are seen. There they come out in front, uncovering their face, revealing who they are. What is occult, hidden and secret, grew there, obvious. And at the same time, what is obvious here kept a covert turn. There's something secret and mysterious about it. And it's very closely touching the unknown. The unseen was felt, not seen. It jostled visible shapes. You know this word jostled? When you're in a crowd and jostling, touching people. Yeah. So the visible shapes and the unseen are very closely touching each other in the world of greater life. We might go there in dreams or in vision. We have some contact. That world is close to ours, gives us our greater movements. So we might feel some of these things. And we might imagine how we could have these experiences in our future development. For example, the next bit that's coming. Karen.
In the communion of two meeting minds, thought looked at thought and had no need of speech. Emotion clasped emotion in two hearts. They felt each other's thrill in the flesh and nerves, or melted each and grew immense, as when two houses burn and fire joins fire. Hate grappled hate, and love broke in on love. Will wrestled with will on mind's invisible ground. Other sensations passing through like waves left quivering the subtle body's frame.
their anger rushed galloping in brute attack, a charge of trampling hooves on shaken soil. One felt another's grief invade the breast, another's joy exulting ran through the blood. Hearts could draw close through distance, voices near that spoke upon the shore of alien seas. There beat a full of living interchange, being felt, even when afar, and consciousness replied to consciousness.
Thank you. Now we are at line 507. So we've heard about such things, imagined such things, maybe even experienced things, this kind of direct communion. Sri Aurobindo speaks about an experience, a concrete experience of somebody's anger coming rushing up the stairs to attack him. Something like that. A charge of trampling hooves on shaking soil. And we might feel the effects of other people's emotions without knowing where they were coming from. It might happen. Could suddenly feel very uneasy without really knowing why, or very uplifted and happy, delighted without knowing why. And he speaks of hearing at a distance, hearing voices that are speaking upon the shore, alien seas far away. For all this is due to a throb, a pulse of living interchange, being felt being, even when afar, even when separated, and consciousness replied to consciousness. But this is not union, this is not a full union, this is an interchange. Fanny, would you read? Oh, okay. Turiya.
And yet the ultimate oneness was not there. There was a separateness of soul from soul, an inner wall of silence to be built, an armor of conscious might protect and shield. The being could be closed in and solitary. One could remain apart himself alone. Identity was not yet, nor union's peace. All was imperfect still, half known, half done. The miracle of inconscience overpassed the miracle of the superconscient, still unknown, self-wrapped, unfelt, unknowable, looked down on them, origin of all they were, as forms they came of the formless infinite, as names lived of a nameless eternity. The beginning and the end were there occult, a middle term worked unexplained, abrupt. They were words that spoke to a vast wordless truth. They were figures crowding an unfinished sum. No one truly knew himself or knew the world or the reality living there enshrined. Only they knew what mind could take and build out of the secret supermind's huge store. A darkness under them, a bright void above. Uncertain, they lived in a great climbing space. By mysteries, he explained a mystery. The riddling answer met the riddle of things. As he moved in this ether of ambiguous life, himself was soon a riddle to himself. As symbols, so all, and so their hands.
Thank you. So there's this possibility of closeness, interchange, communion. But this is not yet the total oneness. There was a separateness of soul from soul. And if wished, an inner wall of silence could be built to keep out all these communications. An armor of conscious might could protect and shield the being. It could be kept closed in and solitary. One could remain apart in self alone. The oneness of identity was not yet there, and nor was the peace of union. There in that world, everything was still imperfect, half known, half done. You remember he said it was a first transition line, a starting point. The miracle of inconscience the inconscience. How can the Supreme Consciousness become inconscient? It's a miracle, and yet that's what seems to happen in the basis of our material universe. Inconscient matter. That has been overpassed. There's life, there's conscious life, but the miracle of the superconscient beyond our imagination, still unknown, self-wrapped, unfelt, unknowable. It's looking down on them. It's the origin of everything they were, as it's the origin of everything that we are, as it looks down on us. Those forms in that world, like the forms in our world, are forms of a formless infinite. We are living as individual beings, and we label ourselves with names. Those beings too, they live as names, but they are projections of a nameless and eternity. For them, as for us, the beginning and the end are hidden, occult, mysterious. What we experience, what they experience, is a middle term, something between the inconscient and the superconscient. It's working unexplained. It's just there. All the words there are words speaking to a vast, wordless truth. Beings are figures, but what are they all going to add up to? An unfinished sum. None truly knew himself or knew the world or the reality living there enshrined.
And that's the reason it cannot add up to a unified sum.
Yes. They only knew what mind could take and hold out of the secret store, endless store of the supermind. There's the darkness of unconsciousness beneath them and a bright emptiness of superconsciousness above. Uncertain they lived in a great climbing space. It seems to have vast possibilities, but full of mystery. By mysteries, they explained a mystery. A riddling answer met the riddle of things. So that's very like our state, especially if we look at it from the life aspect rather than from the body aspect.
Can you usually depict all these secret societies with their mysteries?
Yes, trying to explain them. And even the scientists. They explain things by more mysteries. No. So, as King Asvapati moved in this atmosphere, this ether of ambiguous life, he soon becomes a riddle to himself. He doesn't know who he is, where he is, what he's doing. He only can see everything in that world as symbols, and he wants to find out the meaning of those symbols. So that will be his quest in the next section. Yes, we are a riddle to ourselves, no? Awful feel like that, yes. Ravi, you like to read?
The living things of death and birth and over shifting borders of soul change, a hunter on the spirit's creative track, he followed in life's fine and mighty trail, pursuing her seal, formidable delight in a perilous adventure. At first, no aim appeared in those large steps, only the wide source he saw all things here, looking towards a wider source beyond. For as she drew away from earthly lines, a tensor track was felt from the unknown. A higher context of delivering thought drove her towards marvel and discovery. There came a high release from pettier cares, a mightier image of desire and hope, a vaster formula of greater healing.
Thank you. This reminds me what Nirodha has told us, that this is Sri Aurobindo's autobiography. All these experiences that are described here as happening to King Asvapati, these are Sri Aurobindo's own experiences, and that's why he can describe them so minutely. No? So in that world, exploring that world of greater life, he's soon a riddle to himself. And so he is exploring there, across the leaping springs of death and birth, moving from the non-mortal state and back again over shifting borders of soul change. He's like a hunter pursuing an animal. No? But what he's pursuing is the creative track of the spirit. Where's she moving? What is she doing? He's following the trails of life, seeing her achievements, her failures, pursuing her sealed, formidable delight. That's the principle of life, no? And this seems to be a very dangerous, perilous adventure, and no end to it to be seen. And at first, it seems as if life is taking these large, adventurous steps without any particular aim, no direction. At first, no aim appeared in those large steps. Only the wide source he saw of all things here, that life energy. And it's looking towards a wider source beyond. Because as she drew further away from earthly lines, the matter, world of matter, he feels a stronger drag and attraction from the unknown. Sri Ramakrishna has said something like this. The nearer we come to spirit, the more its magnetism attracts us. No? This tenser drag was felt from the unknown. It exerts a stronger and stronger power of attraction on him. And it seems as if a higher context of delivering thought, maybe life is getting some sense of purpose, driving her towards marvel and discovery. And as she moves further, there came a high release from pettier cares, all the things that we have to worry about every day, all the little material things. A mightier image of desire and hope, a vaster formula, a greater scene, higher and higher, wider perspective. Yes?
This part, when you read, is exactly the experience of the mother in 1965.
Yes.
It's very, very, very interesting. Some friend fighting with mother about the way
he
wants, and mother can know it for her.
Poonam, you would read.
As she circled towards some far off light, her signs still covered more than they revealed, but tied to some immediate sight, they lost their purpose in the joy of you, till stripped of their infinite meaning, they became a cycle gleaming with unreal sand. Armed with a magical and haunted bow, she aimed at a target kept invisible and ever deemed remote, though always near.
Let's pause here a moment. So this is the signs of life, like the signs of our earthly life. They're still covering things up more than revealing them. But there's some delight in enjoying them, tied to some immediate sight and will. He enjoys using them, but they lose their meaning. They lose that infinite meaning which they're expressing. They just become a cipher, a sign which has no meaning, unreal sense. So he sees life also as a huntress with a bow, armed with a magical and haunted bow. She's going to aim at her prey, no? She aimed at a target that's always kept invisible. And however near it is, it seems very, very far away. It's one image, interesting image of the experience that he's having. And then there's a second image. You can go on, please, Poonam.
As one who spells illumined characters, the key book of a crabbed magician text, he scanned her subtle, tangled, bowed,
weird
designs, and the screen difficult turn of her clues. Traced in the monstrous sense of desert time, the thread beginnings of the Titan world watched her
charade
of action for some hand, read the no gestures of her
silhouette,
and strove to capture in their burden drift the dance fantasia of her sequences escaping into rhythmic mystery. A glimmer of fugitive feet on fleeing soil.
Let's look at this. closely. This is Asvapati's experience. It's like reading an ancient book of magic spells, and it's been written in very tiny letters, very close together, so it's very difficult to read them, crabbed writing. In those days when parchment or paper was so difficult to come by, those who wrote, they had to write very, very small, and the forms of their letters are difficult to read. It's a book of spells, a magician text. Asvapati is trying to read the mystery of life, the mystery book of life.
What does it mean?
Crabbed. It means curled up and tight. People sometimes have crabbed faces. Yes, what does it say there?
Perversely intricate by design and difficult to interpret or decipher.
Difficult to decipher to start with. It's physically very, very difficult to read. Yeah. Those old books, some of them are very beautifully decorated, but some of them, the letters are small and black and very difficult to make out. That's what I understand by a crabbed text. But he's scanning those books and trying to make out the meaning of these tangled, weird designs. It seems to give some clues, but they're screened and difficult. Maybe they are theorems, very difficult to understand. First he's looking in a book, but then it says that he's tracing in the sands of time what has happened in the past. No? The thread beginnings, the very, very small, fine, difficult to find beginnings of the immense achievements of life. He watches her actions. What has she done? What is she doing? As if they were a charade. Has anybody played charades when they were children? You get into teams. Of course, it depends how many you are. And you decide on a secret word or a phrase. And then you split it up into bits, syllables, separate words, or if it's a phrase, and you have one person has to act out, do a little mime, a little act, and the others have to guess what that word might be. And then you try and guess all the bits and put it together and get the result. So it's something like that he's trying to do from her action. What might it mean if we put it all together? What does it mean? And another thing he's looking at is the no gestures of her silhouette. No is a kind of Japanese theater, I think, Tomoko. Yes? Do the actors, they do gestures? Is it like that? It has meanings. Sorry? They speak also. But here he says silhouettes, as if it's being acted out against a screen and we only see the outlines of the actors. No, it's not like that. Okay. Anyway, this no gestures, it seems to be something very mysterious that he has to read. Strove to capture their burdened drift. What is the meaning of those gestures and this dance that she's doing, the dance fantasias of her sequences? That she's dancing, life is dancing. What does her dance mean? He just sees this little glimmer of the light left by her feet on this soil as she moves away from him. Kavita?
In the labyrinth pattern of her thoughts and hopes and the byways of her intimate desires, in the complex corners crowded with her dreams and rounds crossed by the entry of irrelevant rounds, a wanderer strained amid fugitive scenes, he lost its sign and chased each failing guest. Ever he met key words, ignorant of their key, a sun that dazzled its own eye of sight, a luminous enigma's brilliant hood, lit the dense purple barrier of thought's sky, a dim, large trance showed to the night her stars.
Thank you. In a labyrinth, you get lost. No? It's a maze. You wander here and there in the byways. It's not the main roads, all the little lanes. complex corners crowded with her dreams. And maybe there's pathways that go in circles, and then there's more confusing pathways circling around. So he's wandering. Aswapati is a wandering wanderer, straying, lost amidst all these scenes, even the scenes he sees them, and then they are gone. He lost the signs. Chased each failing guess. He always seems to be meeting words that have some very significant meaning, key words that will open up the mystery, but he doesn't know how to use them, doesn't know how to understand them.
He goes to ignorant of their key. It is keys, the ignorant are the keys.
I think he's ignorant, I think. What? Margaret's asking about this line 580. Ever he met key words, ignorant of their key. And I think Margaret's asking, is it the words that are ignorant, or is it King Aswapati? I think it is Aswapati. He can see that this is a key word, but he doesn't know how to use it because he doesn't know its meaning. That's how I'm understanding the line. And then there's this mysterious three lines. He's lighted by a sun, but that sun is dazzling, can't see. No? That sun is like a brilliant hood of luminous enigma. Enigma is puzzle, mystery, and yet it seems to be carrying some light. That's what's lighting up the dense purple barrier of thought's sky. It's a dark sky. There's some light. So it's as if he's in a kind of trance, experiencing a dim, large trance, which reveals to the night her stars, her little points of light, each of which is a truth. It's very difficult, all this, isn't it? It goes on. This whole section is about the mysteriousness of life. How can the workings of the greater life be understood? And he comes to the conclusion that she herself doesn't understand. You have to. No choice. Yes. Let's stop there for today.